I want to speak to you from the 11th verse, where Jacob responds to Esau and says, "Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." And he urged him, and he took it. 20 years and more, there was an attitude of animosity, and I suppose in both cases of some fear between these two brothers. But that animosity will be resolved tonight in this 33rd chapter of Genesis. Jacob has feared, and rightly so, the anger of Esau. And he's responded in chapter 32 in every human way he can to protect his assets and his interests. Esau, in a very godly manner, has forgiven his brother of his deceit and deception and comes to seek peace with Jacob. You know, God works in strange ways his wonders to perform. Tonight, if the Lord will help me, I want to bring you a message that I have entitled Jacob and Esau Reunited. It's interesting, these two men both say to each other, "I have enough." I wondered about this. I thought about this a lot in the last week or so. I have enough. I have enough. It made me remember one time, probably 40 years ago or close to it, Brother Clark was preaching a meeting up in eastern Kentucky, and I went up there with him one day, and we went to a family's home, and I thought I was poor. And we sat down at this house, didn't have any screens on the windows or anything else. The furniture was old and worn. The floors were sagging. And it was just it wasn't much of a place as far as this world was concerned. And we had supper with an old man and an old woman who were members of the church where he was preaching. The pastor was there. And we walked in the house, took us into the kitchen, we sat down at the table, and I thought, these poor folks, how can they afford to feed us? And the lady reminded me of my grandmother a little bit. She was worse than a bumblebee with a tick. I'm telling you, she was just jumping around. She was so happy to have us in her house. I don't remember what we ate. It was something real simple, like brown beans and cornbread and something else, corn pudding or something like that. And she'd made a homemade pie. But it thrilled me to sit there and listen to her and her husband talk about how good God was, that he had blessed them so much. And I'll be honest with you, it shamed me. I thought, I'm never going to complain again about my lot in life. I probably did through the years, but God's brought me to a place in my life now where it doesn't take much for me. And I can relate to this. I have enough. There are several things I want to try to look at in this chapter, if the Lord will help me. First of all, in the first four verses, remember in chapter 32, Jacob had orchestrated all these animals, and he'd sent them ahead with some men when he heard that Esau was coming as a present to him. And But in the first four verses of this 33rd chapter, we find them finally getting together. Jacob comes to this event as a man who's fallen, a man who's been changed. He's no longer the deceiver, the foot grabber that he once was, but he comes here in God's power. Verse 28 of the 32nd chapter, it says, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." How should that affect your life and mine? Because if you're trusting Christ tonight, God has said the same thing to you that He said to Jacob. You're not Jacob anymore. You're not the foot grabber. You're not the supplanter, the deceiver, the liar. You're Israel. You're like a prince or a princess that has power with God and with men, and you have prevailed. Now, I tell you, some days I don't know whether I'm prevailing or not. But God says I have. And Jacob's tenacity is still in his flesh. Because in verses 2 and 3, we see him positioning his family so that he has a better chance for some of them to escape if a conflict breaks out. And he's still not sure about Esau. It says, "Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. And he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel, unto two handmaids. He put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost." Now that is our friend Jacob. That's the way he works. He's got them all lined up according to how he likes them. But something's changed. Chapter 32, he was planning on putting them all out there in front, and he was going to stay in the back. But in verse 3, we read this: "He passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother." Jacob's advancement. Jacob going before his family. Jacob leading the way is a beautiful picture of Christ's unequaled love for his people in times of danger. If Christ intercedes for me, it's enough. Makes no difference what I have or don't have to fight with. Makes no difference what I have or don't have to live with or on in this world. If Christ is interceding for me, it's enough. It's enough. Now, Jacob's scheming was soon to appear rather trivial and unnecessary because Esau completely surprises him. He had heard back in the previous chapter, Esau's coming, and he's got 400 soldiers with him. And Jacob's knees begin to knock. And we find Esau coming. He looked up and he saw Esau coming, and with him 400 men. But he's surprised because in verse 4 it tells us Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him. And they wept. Esau demonstrates true forgiveness. And he demonstrates a reconciliation from his heart that Jacob hadn't seen in over 20 years. It is significant to me that neither Esau nor Jacob even mentions the cause of their separation some 20 years before. Well, Jake was bound to learn something because he kept his mouth shut. He didn't say anything. I can just picture him saying, well, I'm sorry for all I did. You know, I cheated you out of your blessing and I stole your birthright. And then I heard you was going to kill me and I run off. But Jacob is silent. My friends, it doesn't always work out the way we want it to in our flesh. But it's important for us. It's important for me. And it's important for you to understand and to know that God works things out for good in our lives. And when we stick our conniving and our plans in there, the only thing we do is create new problems that have to be solved. Just rest in God. Esau ran to meet him. And he embraced him. And he fell on his neck. And he kissed him. And they wept. I was reading that Monday and I thought about the prodigal son. He's down there in that hog pen. They won't even give him some peanut shells to eat. He's starving to death. And he gets to thinking about it. My father has got servants by the hundreds that eat better than this, that live better than this. I'm going home and ask my daddy if he'll let me be his servant. And he gets almost back to the old home place. And he sees a man on the front porch of the old house. And he starts running. And he runs and he grabs him and he said, my son that was dead is alive. He said, bring me a ring, put on his finger. Bring some shoes, put on. Somebody go kill a fatted calf. Let's have a party. My son that was dead is alive. Esau ran to meet him, embraced him, fell on his neck, kissed him, and they wept. In the next few verses, we find the introduction of Jacob's family to Esau. They've never seen Esau before. He's never seen them. When Jacob left their homeland over 20 years ago, he was a scallywag, heading for the hills, trying to save his hide. And his brother was angry enough to take it if he could get his hands on him. But this delightful little flock of children and wives are the result of God's benevolence. And they're presented to Esau. He lifted up his eyes, it says, and he saw the women and the children, and he said, who are those with thee? And he said, the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. The 127th Psalm says this in verses 3 and 4. Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As heirs are in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of the youth. We live in a time when families are small. Most people only have one or two children at the most. I think Sandy and Patsy are tied with five apiece. But that's unusual. Even four or five is unusual. I was talking to a man today somewhere. And he told me that his brother had been here for Easter. And he said, he's the youngest and I'm the oldest. And I said, how many brothers and sisters do you have? He said, I've got 9 still alive. I said, I'm the oldest, he's the youngest. I said, you've been blessed. He said, I really have been. It's good to have big families and get together. I remember as a child, my grandparents had a lot of children. I had to have back in those days to run a farm. We'd get together and have family gatherings and family reunions, and it was nice to see the cousins, every once in a while and get together, and the children would talk, and the grandchildren and great-grandchildren would play, and it was a marvelous experience. And now here's all of Jacob's family. 11 sons, one daughter, 2 handmaids and 2 wives. He said, then the handmaidens came near, they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near and bowed themselves, and after came Joseph near and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. Note the order of the presentation as part of Jacob's selfish plan of self-defense. He had them all lined up in case a furor broke out. If Esau came with these 400 soldiers to do destruction, he's going to have a reign so the ones he liked the best would have a chance to get away. And Esau asked him a question. If you'll remember back in the previous chapter, he talked about how he sent 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 foals. And Esau asked him here in the 8th verse, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? By all these animals. Looked like it's having a stockyard day or something like that. And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. Jacob's gift, and it was a sizable gift, had a couple of prevailing aspects with it. First of all, Jacob's guilty conscience just doesn't know how to be cleared by Esau's gracious forgiveness of his sins. There's some people, maybe you know some, maybe you've been there, who just don't know how to forgive. Who don't know how to accept the forgiveness of another person. And Jacob was that way. He said, I'll buy his forgiveness. I'll send all these animals out to him. I'll repay him for all I did. He couldn't deal with it. The second thing was that the redemption that he might receive through the giving of all these animals made it easier for Jacob to accept Esau's forgiveness. Esau offered him his forgiveness freely. He didn't want anything. He wept. He embraced Jacob and fell on his neck and kissed him. He had completely forgotten everything. But Jacob's humanity said, I just got to do something. I got to do something. I spent a great deal of my life in exactly the same situation. It's taken me now to be an older man to learn that all that stuff is just a waste of time. You just trust God. Esau needed no gifts from Jacob. He didn't need to be bribed to persuade him to accept his brother's apology. Esau said in verse 9, I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself. Now, from verse 9 down through verse 16, we find Jacob's gifts and Esau's response to them. We'll find it detailed here. Jacob said, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And he urged him, and he took it. You know, it's one thing to have enough of this world's goods, but it's an entirely different thing to have the Lord himself as our portion. Back in chapter 27, verse 38, Esau said unto his father, "Hast thou but one blessing, my father?" You see, Jacob had already deceived him. Jacob had already gotten Esau's blessing. Esau comes back and he says, "Father, have you only got one blessing you can give me?" Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac, his father, answered and said unto him, "Behold, thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above." Now Esau was content with what God had provided him. He said, "I've got enough." Jacob had Isaac's blessings. He tricked him and deceived him to get them, but he had them. But don't forget that Esau had Isaac's wealth. Isaac had died in this 20-year journey of Jacob's, and all his livestock and all his property had fallen into Esau's hands. So they both had plenty. We find Jacob's insistence that Esau receive these gifts that he had sent. He said, I know you don't need them, but I sent them anyway. Now, to Jacob's credit, he had done what was right. And in so doing, he had showed that his wrestling with God in the previous chapter had not been in vain. Sometimes we read Jacob in the Old Testament reminds me of Peter in the New Testament. He'll do one thing good, and then 5 minutes later he'll do something really bad. And you don't ever know where he is until he gets to be an old man. Reconciliation requires that those who have done wrong admit it. It's taken me a long time to learn this. To learn that those who have been wrong just need to admit it. I was wrong. And that those who have been wronged need to learn to accept their apology. I have to admit to you that I've had people apologize to me, and I thought to myself, well, till tomorrow. But as I got older, God taught me that they apologized. Mean it or not, they apologized. And you take it as that. And it's been a blessing to do so. Esau said, "I have enough." Jacob said, "I have enough." Esau had much indeed. He had all of Isaac's wealth, and Isaac was the wealthiest man in that part of the world. But Jacob had everything, because he not only had all the wealth that he had gained in Laban's camp and as they traveled, but he also had the presence of God. And I know this sounds trivial to most people. I hope you're not part of that group. But if you've got little with God, you've got more than the man or woman that has everything in this world and doesn't have God. And I know a lot of those folks. I'm at the point in my life where I go to a lot of funerals. And I see a lot of folks put away awful nice. And I wonder, at more funerals than not, I wonder if they knew the Lord. I wonder if they knew the Lord. And verse 12, Esau warmly and cordially invites Jacob and his family to travel back home with him. He said, "Let us take our journey and let us go, and I will go before thee." Sound like a nice offer. Generous offer. Gracious offer. He's saying, "You come back home with me, we'll split this land up, it's Isaac gave it to you." But here we find Jacob, like Peter, going in the wrong direction. He said to him, "My Lord knoweth that the children are tender, and the flocks and the herds with young are with me, and if men should overdrive them one day, all the flock will die." He said, "You guys go ahead. We'll kind of hang back here. We got all these children," and they were small children. But he always got small sheep and small goats. And he said, "You all go ahead, and we'll stay here." Jacob's deceitfulness left a stain on him that had problems that would span their families for generations. Now, we live in a world where our rebellion or our submission can have either very horrible or very wonderful consequences, not only on us, but on others. And in the next few verses, Jacob repeatedly lies in response to Esau's kindness. Esau says, "We'll make whatever arrangements you need. I'll leave some of my men here to help guide you and help protect you. And we'll go ahead, do whatever you want to do." And Jacob's always got an excuse. Jacob tinkers. That's a word I've heard all my life. Somebody tinkering. Jacob tinkers with Esau's forgiveness, as men so often do. And in doing so, he creates a separation that he thinks is good, but it will last for centuries. He says, verse 14, "Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before his servant. I will lead on softly, according as the cattle that goeth before me and the children be able to endure until I come unto my Lord unto Seir," or Mount Seir, which is where he lived. Now Esau makes another offer. This offer was a clear indication of his readiness to forgive Jacob and to show that his forgiveness was genuine. Esau said, verse 15, "Let me now leave with thee some of the folks that are with me." And he said, "What needeth it? Let me find grace in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way unto Seir. Now, a true change of mind and a true change of heart is demonstrated clearly in Esau's offer. Over 20 years ago, the last thing that Jacob heard was from his mother's lips, "As soon as your daddy dies, he's going to kill you." And now we find Esau making offer after offer of kindness and gentleness and sweetness to his brother. A true change of heart, a true change of mind is demonstrated in his actions. Brother Barnard used to say a man can't go from no faith the faith without a change. You know, this was probably Esau's finest hour. We like to look at people, and we like to see men and women that are conquerors, that are overcomers, that are victorious, that charge through the world and accomplish their thing and do their objective and meet their goals. Here we find this man. He was a great hunter, a leader of men, a man of force and brutality. He comes to his brother and he says, "Whatever you want. We can travel together. I'll go ahead. Y'all follow on. Whatever you want to do." And the Bible tells us that he returned that day on his way unto Seir. Unfortunately, his descendants and Jacob's descendants will battle for centuries to come. The seed of Edom, the sons of Esau, will be in constant conflict with the children of Israel for ages to come. Now, there's one other thing I want to look at in verses 17 through 20. Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built him a house and made booths or stalls for his cattle. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. Now, I must tell you that Seir is in the opposite direction. As soon as Esau and his soldiers headed for home, Jacob did a 90-degree turn and went the other way as fast as he could. Now, God had told him once, and God will tell him again. In chapter 35, the first verse, God said unto Jacob, "Arise and go up to Bethel and dwell there and make there an altar unto God." He had already told him once before to go back to Bethel. But here we find him coming to this place called Succoth. And, you know, in backsliding, there's two kinds of backslidings. And they're both pretty common in today's world. We think about a backslider, we think about somebody that used to come to church. Maybe they were a preacher, maybe they were a song leader, and they've turned into a drunk or a drug addict or cheating on their wife or their husband or something, and they're out walking in the world and they have nothing to do with the church. But that's one kind of backslider, but that's the most uncommon kind. The silent backsliders, churches are full of them, are people who've forgotten to read the Bible and forgotten to pray and forgotten their dependence on God and forgotten their blessings from God. And Jacob has become one of those. And although Jacob moved on his own, or he thought he was moving on his own, God's mighty hand was still on him and still on his family, even though they're going in the wrong direction. You see, the children of grace, all of us, must always feel God's touch on us. We might be going to a picnic, or to the hospital. We may be going to get an inheritance, or we may be going to the funeral home. But wherever you're going, if you're a child of God, you go there with God's hand on you. And it is critically important for you to be happy and blessed that you understand that and that you strive and seek as hard as you can to feel God's touch. And even when you can't, say, "Lord, I can't feel it, but I still touch you." For Jacob to build an altar was a good thing, but it wasn't the best thing. Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. And he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar, and he called it El Elohe Israel. You see, God had told Jacob, go to Bethel. But Jacob had gone to the wrong city. He thanked God in a sacrifice, even though he wasn't really serving God at the time. He was doing just the opposite of what God told him to do. He built this altar to God, El Elohe Israel. It was a memorial that had promises and signs of God's presence all about it. It was an external profession of an internal change of heart. You know, folks, we are a mess. We look good on the outside and we're rotten on the inside. And then other times we're rotten on the outside and we're right on the inside. And it's confusing to me sometimes where I am. It was a reminder to his family . Remember Rachel. We're not too sure about Rachel. She stole her father's gods and this, that, and the other. But it's a reminder to his family of the presence of the true God. And the offerings that he made there were a commitment to God and to himself to affect his worldly affairs with a spiritual perspective. The church has always been a mess. It's always dealt with poor people like they were the only people on earth and ignored the rich people. And the rich people feel ignored by the church and need it worse than about anybody. But whatever we do, whether we're rich or poor or in between, it is important that we live in such a way that God is seen in our life. It's a great privilege for us to know God as our God. A lot of people know God as somebody else's God. It does them no good. Greatest privilege you have. I was sitting at the house this morning and I was reading. And I got Lonnie on my mind and I just stopped and talked to the Lord about it for a few minutes. I thought, what a great blessing. I just talked to God. Jacob built this altar to God. He built it in the wrong place. But he built it to his great God. You know, God will use his contacts to hold us and to bring us back to a place of full blessing. I like that passage of Scripture in Hebrews chapter 10, where the writer said this, "And let us consider one another, to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching." I don't know how much you folks keep up with religion in general, but one of the hot trends in religion, there's two hot trends in religion in the United States right now. One of them is to build churches as big as you can build them. It doesn't make any difference who's there, or what you do. Just build big. We got one in Louisville that's so big they have to run buses for hours. The parking lot looks like Fayette. No, I don't know where that big mall is over in Lexington. Or bigger. But the other trend, which is growing even faster, is what they call house churches. People just have decided that church is too much trouble for them, too much aggravation. And they just started meeting two or three couples or four couples or half a dozen couples. They get together in one another's houses every week or so, and they have a little lunch, a little Bible study. That's good enough. They're both wrong. In my opinion, my interpretation of Scripture, they're both wrong. God would have us get together. There are not many folks here tonight. Never are. Last Sunday, I thought, there ain't going to be anybody here. I looked around for another place is full. The thing that's important is that God's people come together with God to hear God for His glory. The true knowledge of God includes a real acquaintance with Him. An acquaintance that produces abundant life and real peace. John 17:3, Jesus said, "This is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent." That's what it's about. Discerning somebody's backslidden condition is important. But discerning your backslidden condition is critical for the maintenance of a productive Christian life. And we're all backslidden at one time or another, in one way or another, to one degree or another. We get that way. We get sidetracked by this world, sidetracked by our interests, and sidetracked by ourselves, and we forget about God. But God's acceptance of the blood of Jesus Christ in our behalf and His allowing us, in fact, enabling us to come to Him through that blood allows God to say the account is settled. It's settled. Several years ago, I was coming back. I don't know where I'd been. I'd been somewhere preaching. I didn't have much money. I had enough gas to get home. And I stopped somewhere. I had $2 or $3, and that was back in. That was enough to get me home. Didn't eat too much. And I stopped in this little restaurant, and I sat there and I looked at the menu and I figured out what I could afford to order, and I ordered what I could afford. And I got ready to leave, and I asked the waitress, I said, "Could I get my check, please?" And she said, "No, you don't have a check." I said, "What do you mean I don't have a check?" She said, "There was a man and his wife sitting over there, and I don't know why, I've never done it before," said they, "just when they checked out and they left, they said, that fellow back there by himself said, give us his ticket. We can pay it for him. Tell him his own gift." I thank the Lord for that, because I really needed to. I was hungry, but I needed to get there. I've thought about that a lot since then. I've done it for other people on occasion. And I always think about what Jesus said. It is finished. It's finished. I thank God for His provision. I thank God for His blessings. I thank God for His direction. And I thank God for His acceptance of such as we are in His dear Son. Esau said, "I have enough." Jacob said, "I have enough." Whatever you have, and we all go through different battles and struggles with this, whatever you have, if you're a child of God, is enough. Because if you needed more, God would give you more. And most of us have too much, and He's just watching to see how we handle what He gives us. All right, we'll stop there tonight. We'll look at chapter 34. One of the great tragedies of the Old Testament. See revenge in action next week in the 34th chapter of Genesis. Amen.